You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to review the debut solo album from Jenny Beth, who's the singer in one of our favorite bands, Savages. And Jim, you in particular have been eagerly awaiting this one.
I have, Mr. Cott. I'm not going to tip my hand because we'll get into the context and our opinions later in the show. First, though, we are revisiting an interview we conducted in 2018. Ray Padgett is a music writer and publicist who's run the Cover Me blog since 2007. His blog highlights a wide variety of notable cover songs that span genres from soul to punk and everything in between. He also wrote a book of the same theme called Cover Me, The Stories Behind the Greatest Cover Songs of All Time. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
Ray, where does the term cover come from?
The term cover came around in the late 40s. The idea, basically, it was an industry thing where record labels would try to have their own version of a big hit. So if Frank Sinatra or whoever has some massive hit, every record label would try to release a sound-alike version, the opposite of what we think of as a cover today, where you make it your own. This is the opposite. They wanted to sound exactly the same. And the idea was literally to cover the original record up in a store shelf.
Mm.
Maybe Frank Sinatra's not a great example, but people back then maybe didn't know who sang every single song they heard on the radio. They just knew the name of the song. So, you know, Mood Indigo. They'd say, I want to buy Mood Indigo. And the record label clerk would just grab whatever version of Mood Indigo was sitting there. Fun fact I learned researching the book is that the Woolworths department store chain had its own record label, the entire purpose of which was to rip off hit songs and put them in their record stores so they made more money rather than selling the original.
Oh, that's insidious.
It's evil.
Wake up, little Susie, wake up. We've both been sound asleep.
Wake up, little Susie and weep. The movie's over, it's 4 o'clock and we're in trouble deep. Wake up, little Susie, wake up, little Susie.
We want to dig deep into some of the stories that you tell, which are fascinating, behind some of the best-known covers, I think, in rock history. But before we get there, give us some philosophy, man. What makes a great cover song?
That's a great question, and I'll answer that first by answering the reverse. What makes a bad cover song? Because you constantly see lists of, like, the worst cover songs ever, and it's, you know, Madonna doing American Pie.
I started singing, bye, bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this will be the day that I die.
Oh, that's bad, yeah.
It's bad, but I would argue that the worst cover song is a tie between every cover song that doesn't change anything from the original. Mm. Which, to answer your question, so that's the first step in a good cover song, is you have to make it your own. You can't just slavishly record, you know, exactly how the Rolling Stones or whoever did it, because what's the point in that? You have to find something in the song that you love, make it your own, but also be irreverent enough to throw away parts of the original and reinvent them.
I don't know if I agree with that.
Okay, let's hear
certainly
it.
We've all endured innumerable bad cover bands, right?
Oh, yes.
But I had a friend who's a rock academic at DePaul University, and she says one of the things that's happening when a band is covering a song that you love on stage is you're hearing the real band in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you're not at the Empty Bottle seeing the Rolling Stones, right? But I'll also throw at you the Feelies, who are, you know, one of, I think, the most inventive bands in rock in the last 30 years, and they're famous for covering songs. And they're always very faithful, but it illuminates their whole aesthetic by showing where they got bits and pieces of it.
I see a rental and I want to paint it black. No colors anymore, I want them to be black. I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes.
See, I wouldn't call them faithful. I agree with you that they're, and bands like them are, you know, copying certain parts of the original. But I feel like if you're feeling it enough, if you're making it your own, another, you know, sort of famous example would be Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll.
Sure.
Huge song, very famous. And if you compare,
and nobody knew the original.
And if you A-B it to the Aeros' obscure original, it's basically the same. The drum parts are the same. The guitar parts are the same.
I saw her dancing there by the record machine. I knew she must have been about 17. The beat was going strong, playing my favorite song, and I could tell everything.
But if you bring a certain passion, a certain dedication, you know, I think that is making it your own, and I think the Feelies are a good example of that.
We're talking to Ray Padgett, the author of Cover Me, the stories behind the greatest cover songs of all time. Kick off your book with Elvis Presley covering Hound Dog. Why'd you lead off the book with that? Why that particular song?
Because I think it sort of marks a transition point in the history of the cover song, and that's what I'm trying to tell throughout the book. Before, you know, the argument is, everything was a cover song sort of before the dawn of rock and roll, or most things. The job title of singer/songwriter didn't really exist in the same way. If you were a singer, you were singing songs that other people had written and often previously recorded. I mean, you could even call every orchestra that performs a Mozart song a cover by some stretch. But Elvis, you know, it's sort of – he never, you know, wrote any of his own songs. And so he's right at the tail end of that tradition, but he's inaugurating a tradition that, you know, follows through to the Beatles and every rock and roll band since, where it soon became a premium to write your own songs. And Elvis, I thought, was an interesting case study of Hound Dog specifically, because that's a song, you know, that's he took from an African-American singer, Big Mama Thornton, who had had sort of a what at the time were termed race hit, which means, you know, a segregated hit with it.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
He sort of reinvented it, you know, made it about a literal dog for, you know, the sort of broader market. And then it ties into an issue the cover songs have had throughout their history, including way back to Elvis, which is, you know, appropriation.
Well, it's a history of rock and roll, isn't it? It's white artists covering black R&B and performers, gospel performers in some cases, and making it their own and selling it to a broader audience. And, you know, hence the idea of appropriation and, you know, cultural colonialism. In your opinion, is he transforming that song? Is he making it better? What's your focus on that song and the way Elvis sings it versus Big Mama Thornton's original?
Well, he's definitely transforming it. I mean, I think Big Mama Thornton's original is fantastic. It's sort of a rough blues number that I think is great. It didn't need to be fixed or improved. What Elvis does is he sort of makes it almost a novelty song, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but he makes it about a dog, first of all, a literal, you know, crying all the time. Hound Dog, and he just sort of hams it up. It's very upbeat. It's danceable. You know, this is the song where he's shaking his hips on Ed Sullivan, mm-hmm. causing so much controversy. So he totally reinvents it. But I think, like, you know, it's a great cover in the sense that they can both coexist. Lieber and Stoller had a funny quote. They wrote the original song, and they said, Elvis's lyrics don't make any sense. He's singing about a dog, but it's a, you know, a low-down dog. But then they would later add, we hated Elvis's cover, ... until the checks started coming in.
Yeah, right. Ray, tell us, how did Elvis discover Hound Dog?
Then this is another complicating factor in this sort of racial appropriation narrative, is that Elvis may or may not have actually heard Big Mama Thornton's original. He took his interpretation, his version about the dog, from this basically Vegas lounge act, and it was a novelty number for them at the end of the show, you know, dance moves, fancy suits, you know, yucking it up. Elvis was on a Vegas concert of his own. He went and he saw them. He loved it. And so all the lines that Lieber and Stoller were complaining about as being Elvis lines about dogs were actually Freddie Bell lines, but Freddie Bell never had success with it.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, a hound dog.
Why is it this iconic song? I mean, it's still, you know, you mentioned Hound Dog, people always associate it with Elvis, unless they really know their stuff.
Yeah.
It's really considered like this ground zero for rock and roll in many ways, and associated with a white artist who's ripping it off from a lounge singer,
who in turn
ripped it off from the originator.
I think it stands out in your book, Ray, as one of the only songs that I think a lot of listeners would not even realize it was a cover.
Yeah.
You know, the others all stand as, you know, original is as big as the cover. But this one, Elvis took.
Yeah, he took it. And it's, yeah, I agree. It's much bigger. And I think it's embodies so much of what made Elvis both great and, you know, hugely popular, which is the energy, the attitude, the swagger. You know, it's a tight song, you know, 2.5 minutes. It just sort of races through. And yeah, I mean, in a way, it's a shame when a cover so eclipses the original that the original gets forgotten in the narrative of music history. I mean, I like I say, I think people should listen to Big Mama Thornton's. I think it has a lot to offer. But, you know, Elvis, especially at the time, was such sort of an all-consuming force that if he did a song, it became an Elvis song, no matter what it was beforehand.
What did Mama Thornton think about it? Did your research point you in any direction in that regard?
She wasn't thrilled for the simple reason that she hadn't written the original song, which means she didn't make any money off of Elvis's version.
Right.
If you write the original song, you make royalties off of anyone who covers it. But if you perform the original song, you don't get anything. And so she was kind of pissed about it, frankly. He has this huge hit. He doesn't credit her specifically. Again, he may, who knows how aware he even was of her version. And so she doesn't get a lot out of it.
I think that's a great point that you just made. I think a lot of songwriters are happy to have their songs covered because obviously it means more money in their bank account, especially if the song does well. But there have been instances of songwriters who have dissed cover versions of songs, even though they have sold scads of copies. It was almost like a condescending, this artist wasn't worthy of that song. You know, I can't believe they butchered it.
They cashed the checks, attitude. But they made
right.
that complaint.
They
exactly.
didn't complain that loudly.
Yeah, but I do remember, like, especially around the punk new wave era when, for example, some of Elvis Costello's songs were being covered.
'Cause I don't know if you are loving somebody. I only know it isn't mine.
He would cast aspersions at some of these artists who were covering. I think Linda Ronstadt was, you know, got in his sights once for a cover of one of his songs.
Prince hated covers of his songs.
Yeah.
Like, that's how sort of I opened my book, is he's trashing the art of the cover song, basically saying, don't cover any of my songs, which is, of course, ironic, because any number of Prince songs were hits from covers, from Cyndi Lauper, When You Were Mine, to Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You.
Nothing compares, nothing compares.
Right.
There have been a million hit Prince covers, but, you know, he was always sort of contrary, and so he hated people covering his songs.
And then you've got an artist like Bob Dylan who, you know, the Basement Tapes are essentially, those songs were all written with the idea that somebody else would perform them. They were never intended to be released. They were basically songs that were, you know, here's a demo, record my song, please, make it a hit, and I'll gladly collect the income.
Yeah, he made it a business model where he recorded these demos. His manager would farm them out. And so many famous Dylan songs, for instance, The Mighty Quinn, you know, Quinn the Eskimo, were released by the cover version, Manfred Mann in that case, before Dylan's version ever came out.
Come without, come on within. You'll not see nothing like the Mighty Quinn. Come on without, come on.
I mean, Dylan's an interesting case. He's the only artist in the book that gets two chapters about covers of his song.
You've got Adele doing him and of course, Hendrix.
Because he's so pivotal in the cover world, because he's someone who writes these great songs, but his actual recordings of them are, shall we say, not mass appeal. He's not having number one hits with his own recordings, but when people with a more commercially palatable voice do them, then they become number one hits.
It does confuse me, Ray, to some extent. You know, I think modern musicians are well aware that sample at your own risk, because you can build a fantastic track out of a sample, but without getting the artist, I mean, it's not going to come out on any sort of legal form without getting the artist's permission, right? But we can cover whatever we want as long as we're paying royalties. But there are several famous incidents throughout history of, like, a band in New York in the 80s, Das Damen, covered Magical Mystery Tour at a point where Michael Jackson owned that part of the Beatles catalog, and SST Records had to, like, take back everything that was in the stores and destroy them.
As long as you don't change a word, you can cover whatever you want. You just have to pay the royalty. So in that case, either it could be they didn't, you know, go through the proper channels to pay the royalty, or it could be if you change even a single word, all of a sudden you need permission. And there's an example of that in the book, which is the Fugees doing Killing Me Softly. They wanted to cover the song. They loved the song. They even went as far as recording it, but they had changed one line. They had changed the chorus from Killing Me Softly with a song to Killing the Sound Boy with his song. And Sound Boy was sort of a Jamaican-influenced hip-hop, you know, you could say wannabe, or it was a diss, basically. So, like, I'm going to kill him, you know, with how much better my song is. So they only changed those two words, Killing Me Softly to Killing the Sound Boy, but then they need to go get permission. And the original writers said, hell no. You can't record Killing the Sound Boy. If you record it, you have to do it the exact same way. So then they had to go back and re-record Killing Me Softly. But I spoke to Praz for the book, and he basically said, thank God they said no, because otherwise no one knows what Killing the Sound Boy meant. It would have stayed within a small hip-hop niche, and instead it became our biggest song. That has been a hit for both Roberta Flack, who was covering a country pop song, and she made it into this, you know, powerful soul song. And then 20 years later, the Fugees bring it into the realm of hip-hop with Lauryn Hill singing the song over basically a hip-hop beat that they took from Tribe Called Quest.
I heard he sang a good song. I heard he had a style. And so I came to see.
And so you can say that's a song that, even though the original version by Lori Lieberman was not a hit,
killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song.
It's such a good song that it just transcends and can be covered over and over and over again.
In myriad styles.
And each version stands on its own.
With his song.
Well, thank you so much. Ray Padgett has been our guest on Sound Opinions, talking about covers in relation to his book, Cover Me. Thanks so much, Ray, for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
When we come back, Greg and I will share some of our favorite cover songs in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with Jim DeRogatis. We've been talking about notable cover songs, and as we've been talking about, a cover in the right hands can really transform a song that you thought you knew, but the cover brings new textures to it that you may not have realized were there. You know, I'm thinking of something like Soft Cell's transformation of that Gloria Jones song, Tainted Love, in the 80s.
Sometimes I feel I've got to.
We thought we'd share a few of our favorites, Jim. You're up first.
You know, absolutely, Greg. Transforming a song is one thing covers do. Another is making connections of influences you might not have suspected in a band. I think a third thing is shining a spotlight on a song that you probably missed because it's so deep and obscure you would have never heard it. I'm going to do two covers. The first does number two and three of what I just talked about. I said in the interview with Ray that the Feelies had a unique way of bringing in all these different influences throughout their history to the songs that they covered. They also had numerous offshoot bands. They had one devoted entirely to covering the psychedelic Beatles, Dr. Robert, and another devoted to just Velvet Underground songs, Foggy Notion. Then there is the band where Dave Weckerman, the veteran percussionist, the guy who plays maracas and second snare drum and tambourine, steps forward and becomes the front person. It was called Young Woo. They are reissuing a great album that came out in 1987, the only album they made ever, Shore Leave. It's out again. It's great to have it back. There's a wonderful cover on it. I was unaware of guitarist Phil Manzanera's first studio solo album, Diamond Head, until Young Woo, the Feelies in Disguise, introduced me to it by a cover. Manzanera, in 1975, moonlighting from Roxy Music, made a fantastic record produced by, co-written songs by, vocals by Brian Eno. Thank you very much. Okay? And even as big of an Eno head as I am, I didn't know the song Big Day. Here's a little bit of Manzanera's version with Eno on vocals.
I'm through with life of the day. I'm through with strength of the dawn. There are mountains piercing our skies, and the ocean at our shores. I will save up all of my wages, even with
so that is a great pop song, Big Day. I think it's a little weak in the Manzanera version. The Feelies beef it up with that classic Feelies rhythm. Dave Weckerman on vocals in Young Woo, you know, adds a new layer of sort of just, gee whiz, I'm a tourist in an exotic place. I'm in Peru. Straw hats, you know. There's a great tradition, I think, in rock and roll of travelogue pop songs of places that the artists clearly have never been.
Right.
You know, you think of something like Istanbul, not Constantinople, right? Or even, I guess, you know, Dylan's Quinn the Eskimo. I don't think he ever went, you know, to the Arctic. And so you're imagining this place you've never been. Big Star's India, right? And you're singing with such passion and fondness, you want to go. Young Woo, Dave Weckerman makes me want to go to Peru on Big Day.
Taking our time.
Covering Phil Manzanera and Brian Eno, Big Day. It's on the reissued Shore Leave record. Buy it if you love the Feelies, if you love Eno.
Mm-hmm. Jim, the song I want to highlight is a classic from the 70s. This artist, Al Green.
The Rev.
And what a remarkable decade he had in the 70s, that conflation of spirituality and sexuality in his songs and how he eventually converted to gospel music after this long period of, you know, wrestling with his feelings about those two areas. This song encapsulates a lot of that internal struggle that Al Green was going through, Take Me to the River. It surfaced in 1974, was co-written with his guitarist, Teenie Hodges, who was part of that great high rhythm section that he recorded many of those classic songs with. And, you know, this is a typical Al scenario here. You've got this idea of a baptism going on, but it's conflated with this idea of this really lusty affair that he's having that isn't going really well. So Al is there's a lot of anxiety anxiety in this song, you know, this mix of spirituality and carnality that he was struggling with at the time, really coming to the fore. These images of take me to the river and being baptized in the river, and at the same time somehow being healed or lifted up in this love affair that isn't going very well. Al Green, there's no one better at sort of struggling with those notions. Here's a little bit of Al Green's original version of Take Me to the River.
I don't know why I love you like I do. After all the changes that you put me through, used all my money in my cigarettes, and I haven't seen how now have you yet. I want to know, won't you tell me? I love to stay.
Now, that song struck a chord with a lot of artists. Among the people who covered that song within the first couple years after it was released were, among others, the Mighty Foghat attempted a cover of Take Me to the River.
And I have never heard that.
And the perverse side of me was tempted to play that version of it, but I don't think it's particularly good. Also, artists like Levon Helm covered it on one of his solo records. Brian Ferry of Roxy Music, another Roxy Music solo spinoff along the lines of the Phil Manzanera track that you just played. And those are fine versions, but I think the best one was the one done by Talking Heads in 1978. And the reason I'm focusing on that is that it's so revelatory, because I think the Talking Heads coming out of that punk and post-punk scene, which was very white, let's put it that way, certainly not a lot of soul or funk associations in that music, or even danceability in a lot of that music. But the Talking Heads were always focused on that side of it. Let's get people on the dance floor. Let's get them dancing. And they didn't quite get there with their first couple of records, but near the tail end of their second record, here comes this track, Take Me to the River, and it's a revelation to everybody. Like, what a great song. Oh, that's that Al Green soul funk song.
Yeah.
What is an uptight white band like the Talking Heads doing, covering this and doing a pretty good job of it? This would lead into a very fertile period of Talking Heads music, where they go full on into the funk with Remain in Light, one of their subsequent records. And, of course, you see a lot of that manifested in that terrific movie, Stop Making Sense, that came out in 1984. But 6 years early, this was kind of like the starting point for me. The incorporation of those funk and R&B grooves into punk in this cover of Al Green's Take Me to the River by Talking Heads. That's Talking Heads from 1978, their cover of Al Green's immortal Take Me to the River. Jim, you've got another cover for us.
I do, Greg. Continuing with the notion of great songs that may have been missed in their original context, John Lennon and Yoko Ono put out a series of three. To call them experimental albums is kind. Unlistenable might be more realistic. Let's face it, genius or no, both of them, there was a lot of dreck. Unfinished Music Number 1, two versions. Unfinished Music 2, Life with the Lions, and Wedding Album, possibly the worst of those three records. Right? Mm. We're just talking like Primal Scream, you know, messing around in bed noise is all these records were. And then in the midst of that final experimental record is this wonderful song called Listen, the Snow is Falling, that Yoko wrote and recorded with John Lennon and Phil Spector helping her produce it. It is a beautiful, stunning pop song in the midst of unlistenable noise, I would say, that's easily overlooked. Now, Yoko's vocals are hard to take. Mm. She's arguably better when she's screaming and yelping and primal screaming. But you can tell that's a good song. How good a song it was brought home to me when Galaxy 500 covered it on the last of their three albums, This Is Our Music. You and I are both huge fans of Galaxy 500. We've had Dean Wareham on the show and Damon Krukowski with his partner Naomi Yang. I think I heard the song before the album was actually out on Rough Trade. I remember standing on one of those horrifyingly minus 25 outside winter evenings in Minneapolis at 7th Street Entry and seeing Naomi take over from Dean on vocals to deliver this Yoko Ono song. And I didn't have any idea that it was a Yoko Ono song.
Right.
Damon's drumming is so sympathetic. Naomi's vocals are beautiful. And the way Dean propels her with the guitar solo, it's just incredible. Listen, The Snow is Falling by Galaxy 500. Galaxy 500 covering Yoko Ono, Listen, the Snow is Falling. Greg, you got one more great cover to share with us.
I do. I want to focus on Dolly Parton's classic 1973 song, Jolene. One of Dolly's greatest hits, without a doubt. The setup for the song is basically this woman, this redheaded woman named Jolene, who is enticing her man away from her, seducing her man. And the narrator in the song fears the worst. Mm. Jolene, I can't compete with you. You're clearly more beautiful than I am, more seductive than I am. I feel incredibly inadequate next to you. You're going to steal my man. Please don't steal my man.
Wow.
There's a melancholy and a regret and a forlorn attitude in this song. It's not like she's condemning Jolene so much as saying, I can't compete with you. Please, please go away quietly so that I can stay with my man.
It is a unique song. You don't often hear that conversation between two women in a song in pop history.
Yeah, and Dolly said that the song was inspired by two things that happened in her life. There was an 8-year-old girl who came up and asked her for an autograph, this redheaded 8-year-old girl. And she asked her name, Jolene. She goes, Mike, that would be a great name for a song. You know, it kind of reminded her of classic J women names, a Jezebel. Bell was another one that sort of pops in your head, like it's an evocative name. And then her husband, apparently there was a redheaded bank teller that her husband seemed to be very fond of, and the bank teller seemed very fond of her husband, and she was jealous. And they were sort of joking around, you're spending a lot of time in that bank. I don't believe we've got that kind of money, you know, that kind of thing. So it partially a joke. She said, you know, there was no affair, but it was just more what was going on in her head, her imagination as a songwriter. So she writes this incredibly melancholic, incredibly beautiful song called Jolene.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene, please don't take him just because you can. Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain.
So this song has been covered many, many times. It's considered one of Dolly's classics. And I think one of the most notable versions was a latter-day version of this song done by the White Stripes. Jack White, a big fan of, you know, vintage country and blues.
Yep.
And he originally recorded the song as a B-side for the Hello Operator 7-inch. And then I think where the song really blossomed for Jack White and the White Stripes was in concert. And that's the version I want to play. There's an official video of a concert performance of this song, in which the reasons for my focusing on this cover become clear. First of all, there's the desperation, the wrenching performance. Whereas Dolly sounded a little forlorn and melancholy, you can see that White is, his narrator, is really tortured by this happening.
Yeah.
And the other part is the little twist he gives to the relationships in this song. The guy is now begging his lover, Jolene, to stop cheating on him with one of his friends. So without changing the gender, he still is able to personalize the song in a way that made it very real for him. So a transformative cover of a great song by the White Stripes, Jolene, on Sound Opinions.
Your beauty is beyond compare, with flaming locks of auburn hair, with ivory skin and eyes of emerald green. Your smile is like a breath of spring, your voice is soft like summer rain, and I cannot compete with you, Jolene. And he talks about you in his sleep, and there is nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene.
The immortal Jolene, White Stripes covering Dolly Parton. As always, we want to hear from you. What is your favorite cover song? Or what's a cover song you love to hate? Call and leave us a message at 888-859-1800. Coming up next, we review the debut solo album from Jenny Beth, and Greg drops a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox and plays us a song he can't live without. What do you have for us, Mr. Cott?
Well, Jim, I'm going to take a little detour into the jazz world and play a track from one of the greatest jazz albums ever made.
That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner, socially distanced still, is Mr. Cott, Greg Cott. And that was a little bit of the song I'm the Man from Jenny Beth's solo debut, To Love Is to Live. Jenny Beth rose to prominence as the front woman, the singer of the band Savages about 9 years ago. Two very strong albums. The last one dropping in 2016. They toured behind that, and then nothing for a long time, or nothing as a band for a long time. Jenny Beth kept busy, to be sure. She had a radio show in the UK, Start Making Sense, that then led to a TV show, Echoes. She's been making music with her partner, Johnny Hostile. They were a duo, an indie rock, kind of folky duo, before Savages launched. And now they're making music together again. None of the other Savages in sight. We're going to play a song from this album, come back and give our opinions. This is the opening track of To Love Is To Live, I Am, by Jenny Beth on Sound Opinions.
I am naked all the time. I am burning inside. I'm a voice no one can hear. I am drifting through the years. I'm burning, your safe is my danger.
That is I Am from the new Jenny Beth solo album, To Love Is To Live. You know, after you do a band like Savages, Jim, guitar-based rock and roll just isn't going to cut it anymore. You know, you can't get much better than Savages. And who knows if we'll see them again or hear them again. I hope we do. But in the interim, Jenny Beth has poured her spirit into this new solo record. I thought the choice of producers was excellent. Flood's work is well known, going all the way back to people like Depeche Mode and U2, the way he was able to sort of create that atmosphere in songs. And Atticus Ross, the partner of Trent Reznor in Nine Inch Nails, that sound is infiltrating pop music in a big way, especially when you think about an artist like Billie Eilish. And I think a little bit of that sound is very much a part of this Jenny Beth record, that sort of electronic underpinning.
Is it a living in the city that turns your heart so small?
And it's disorienting, you know. It kind of veers from Jenny being this sonic adventurer. She is in the mode of, I'm going to try something new here. I'm kind of out in new territory and figuring it out as she goes along. And I love that sense of uneasiness that pervades this record. I think what she's really talking about in many of these songs is self-discovery. In that song, French Countryside, she says it's hard sometimes to show who you really are. And I think that's really the key to this record for me. You're looking at the bad and good of what it means to be a human being. Here is a woman going through this process of self-discovery and basically letting us in on what's going on inside her head. This is a 180 from where Savages was, but I think it's a brilliant move for Jenny Beth as a solo artist.
Okay, Greg. When I teach criticism to my students, there's two things I always tell them. One comes from you, which is, if you're going to give a bad review, make sure it is never gratuitously mean. It is something you would read to the artist standing in front of him or her. The other is what I call the ugly baby rule. Now, you know, some babies are just ugly. They look like Winston Churchill's bulldog, right? But in polite society, say at Thanksgiving dinner, you cannot turn to a cousin and say, boy, that is one ugly baby. This is an ugly baby. I have not been this disappointed in an album in so long. I don't know if I've ever been this disappointed in an album.
Wow, really?
It is just a horrible mess. I liked it more at first just because I was living for every time I'm the Man came around. I also very much like How Could You, which builds from this blissful sound to just noise explosion.
How could you?
The rest of it is Jenny stumbling in the dark, looking for something, taking herself way too seriously. That tune, A Place Above, which is a spoken word poem by Killian Murphy of Peaky Blinders. What is that doing here? I have no idea.
See the delusions of those who succeed. Their imagined self-importance. See the most powerful man raise his hand to tell us a lie.
The keyboards, I think she was going for Patti Smith in ethereal, ambient, almost Easter mode. And instead she winds up on the musical theater stage. And, she had some of that in her background. And it goes from drama, right past drama, to melodrama, as far as I'm concerned. And it's just disastrous. I don't want any artist to stay stuck in the past, but I so miss the 1-2 punch of Eshe Hassan and Faye Milton on that rhythm section. Gemma Thompson was one of the most inventive guitarists I'd heard since Kevin Shields of My Bloody Valentine. I'm not saying to stay with Savage's. Savage's future is uncertain, is what I'm getting from my sources. I'm friends with Jenny's sister. You know, as a great writer, I'm going to have everybody hating me because I called it an ugly baby. But this album actually physically hurts my stomach. Greg, you know how I feel about drummers, and you are going to give the drummer some with a tribute as you head off to the desert island.
Indeed, Jim. Jimmy Cobb, great jazz drummer, died at the age of 91 on May 24th at his home in Manhattan. What a career Jimmy Cobb had, stretching back to 1950, including collaborations with people like Wayne Shorter, Art Pepper, John Coltrane, you name it. Jimmy Cobb probably played with that artist over the last 50 years. Plus 19 solo albums starting in the 80s. A self-effacing drummer, was always about serving the song, the arrangement. And by the way, he happened to play with Miles Davis on 9 studio albums that Davis recorded. Because of that nature, that self-effacing, serve the song nature, he also happens to be the last surviving member of the famed band that recorded Miles Davis's Kind of Blue in 1959. Perhaps the most famous jazz recording ever made. I think just about everybody who owns only one jazz album, that's probably the one. It has endured for decades because it is a masterpiece and includes some of the greatest musicians in jazz history. Besides Davis, you had Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Bill Evans, Paul Chambers. Not many people know the name Jimmy Cobb, but he was the drummer on that particular record. And as I mentioned, there was a reason Davis picked him. These arrangements were designed to be more impressionistic and free-flowing. Modal jazz, basically, instead of more traditional chord-based styles. Who was the perfect drummer for that setting? Jimmy Cobb. He was a guy who could help keep the flow moving, could serve the mood of these songs, the subtlety, the agility, the flexibility required to make these songs work. Cobb was the man. And his role perhaps is underrated in how good this record turned out, because he served all these master musicians in a self-effacing, modest, understated manner, and yet the record moves beautifully. Every track seems to have a flow to it. And to me, there's 5 tracks on this record, not a dud among them. So I want to give you a piece of one of those tracks to give you an example of Jimmy Cobb as part of one of jazz history's greatest ensembles. Here's a bit of Freddie Freeloader from Miles Davis's Kind of Blue, featuring Jimmy Cobb on Sound Opinions. Thank you.
Freddy Freeloader from Miles Davis's classic Kind of Blue with the great Jimmy Cobb on drums in tribute to him, dead at the age of 91. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have one of those list shows that we love so much. This is going to be a list of our favorite albums of 2020 so far.
I'm looking forward to it. You can download Sound Opinions wherever you get your podcast thingies. Thanks, as always, to our producers, Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, and Andrew Gill. And a special shout-out to the engineers keeping WBEZ running down at Navy Pier.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800.
Messages. Hi, this is Mike from Louisville, Kentucky. I wanted to thank you for the great episode on historical songs and to let you know of one that just came out a few weeks ago that I'm just very fond of. Steve Earle and the Dukes have a song called Fastest Man Alive that ends their wonderful new album, Ghost of West Virginia. And at first, it sounds just like another great up-tempo number from Steve Earle, a guy who's been doing it for 4 decades. But when you dig deeper and realize it's about Chuck Yeager, it really sets the tone and to me is one of the better historical songs you'll hear from Steve Earle or anybody. Thanks, guys. Keep up the great work.
I'm a lover, I'm a father, I'm a sinner, I'm a saint, I'm a mover, I'm a shaker, ask your brother if I ain't. I'm the rumble in the thunder, I'm the bolt out of the blue, I'm a master of the stratosphere, pilot trodden through, name is strong, hell with Yeager and I'm everywhere, Paris, London, Timbuktu, and Dover, Delaware. In California, that's where I'm gonna die. I come from West Virginia, I'm the fastest man alive.
Jim and Greg, this is Scott from Gangsta Island, and I just listened to you guys' show about concerts that shaped our lives. And let me tell you guys, I saw Parliament Funkadelic in 1995 at the Taste of Chicago, right there where you guys are. I was 12 years old at the time. And early in the concert, they started to play Maggot Brain. And let me tell you, everybody in the whole crowd started to pass out. It was simultaneously the most exhilarating and disturbing and powerful thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And when the song was over, everybody magically snapped right back into grooving and moving. I've never seen anything like it. Don't expect to anytime soon. Anyways, you guys keep doing what you're doing right over there in Chi-Town.
Yeah, this is Michael. I'm calling from Pagosa Springs, Colorado. The greatest concert ever for me. I was lucky enough to be 10 years old in 1979 when the Bee Gees went on tour and I got to see them in Providence, Rhode Island. My folks got a limo and took us to the show. We were in the 11th row. Maurice was wearing a white suit and a beautiful white Panama, running the whole band. I was only 10. My life changed at that moment. I liked music before. I loved music after that evening. Out of all the hundreds of bands I've seen over the years, that day in 1979 changed my life. Loved your show. And peace towards everyone. Thank you.
Hi, this is Glenn. I'm calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I wanted to chime in about a concert that I saw that I'm sure some other people may even call in about, which was seeing U2 on the War Tour in 1983 here in Chapel Hill. U2 actually were not even the headliners. They were playing a festival with Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, the producers, and then following U2 was Todd Rundgren. But U2 put on a show of a lifetime. It was only my second ever concert, still my favorite concert of all time. Thanks for the show. Bye bye.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.